You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. In the mid-19th century, immigrants from Nordic countries, meaning Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, settled in Wisconsin. Nordic culture is still visible all over the state, and an important part of any culture is food.
For this Food Friday, we're focusing in on Nordic food culture with the author of The Nordic Cookbook. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What Nordic cooking traditions does your family follow? What traditional Northern European dishes do you serve? And how has the food traditions from those countries influenced the food your family eats? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Magnus Nilsson joins us now. He's the head chef of Favikan Restaurant in Sweden and the author of The Nordic Cookbook. Magnus, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, this is a huge book, over 750 pages, and you were a little averse initially to writing about Nordic cooking because you thought, how can there really be a cookbook about that? It's too broad. What made you change your mind?
Well, I think that, like, the thing with the Nordic region is that it's a geographical construction. You know, someone sat down and decided that these countries, they belong in a region together, but it's a very big geographical area and a lot of, you know, diversity within. So it's not a homogeneous cultural region. And to me, that was kind of, you know, the reason I said no at first, and then also the reason that I actually changed into wanting to write the book, simply because most people don't even know what the Nordic region, even within the region, is.
So how similar are the food cultures in Norway and Denmark and Sweden? And then also you have Iceland and Greenland and the Faroe Islands and Finland. How similar are they?
Well, they're more similar to each other within the Scandinavians, like, you know, the three countries of Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, than the outlying countries, for example, Finland. And there are, like, actually no real sort of pan-Nordic dishes that are the same across the whole region. But there are things, though, that remain similar or that exist in versions across the whole region.
And you did exhaustive research for this book, and I want to quote from your introduction. It made me laugh. You said, "I realized that most of what has been published in English on Nordic and Scandinavian home cooking really sucks." That's your quote there. You were reviewing all kinds of cookbooks that were out there.
Yeah.
What's wrong with what's already out there existing on this food culture?
Well, the thing is that, like, most of the books that have been published before, they were a very comprehensive collection of recipes, and the recipes themselves might have been good, but there were no context supplied with the recipes, meaning that, you know, without prior knowledge, it was very difficult to actually understand why they made sense. Or they were just, you know, ordinary cookbooks with, you know, let's make a duck dish, and then we add lingonberries, and now it's a Swedish duck, which is not particularly representative either.
So as part of the research for this book, you surveyed people about Nordic cooking. What did you learn, and how did those results influence the book? Were there any surprises for you?
Well, I learned that the way people perceive their own food culture is often quite different from reality. We often have a romanticized version, like, or idea of our own culture that isn't actually what, you know, people practice when they cook on an everyday basis in their homes, which I thought was quite interesting.
Now, one thing you say is that you may cook verbatim what is written in the book and these recipes, and it still may turn out different than you expect. And to that end, you sort of advise including the gram scale measurements. Tell us about why those are better.
Well, I think that they're just more exact. You know, because if you say that something is 182 grams, it's going to be 182 grams. If you say that something is a scant cup, that's not going to be a precise measurement. And in certain recipes, I think that it doesn't matter if you have precise measurements at all, because it's more important that you taste and feel what's right. But in other recipes, especially pastry recipes, those sort of grams in difference, you know, they can actually make a huge impact on the end result.
And so, Magnus, you are the head chef and the owner of Favikan, one of the top-rated restaurants in the world, but you are also looking at home cooking. How do you kind of bring together that very high-level cooking and the down-home cooking?
Well, all cooking in restaurants like Favikan, it's really a reflection of the food culture in an area or in a place, but, you know, maybe elevated and passed through kind of a contemporary and very ambitious filter. But it all comes from home cooking at some level. Like, you know, the food we eat in very ambitious and expensive restaurants is just a different version of food culture practice in people's homes.
Let's get to some of the food here as we talk to Magnus Nilsson, head chef of Favigan Restaurant in Sweden and the author of the Nordic Cookbook. One of those basic apparently meals in Nordic culture is a sandwich, and it's hard cheese, butter, and bread. Tell us about the role just sort of the basic sandwich might play.
The sandwich is actually very interesting as a culture marker because it's something that is one of the few things that you'll find across the whole Nordic region, though it's not the same, you know, from one place to another. The only common denominator might be that this is a piece of bread of some kind with some kind of topping on it. And what kind of bread and what kind of topping and how it's eaten, it says a lot about the country. You can look at, for example, Denmark, which have a, you know, a great tradition in open sandwiches. And Denmark as a country is a very rich agricultural region. It's also the gateway for trade between the Nordics and Europe, at least historically. And this has led to, you know, a huge richness in produce. And you can see that on the sandwiches. They're so fully laden that you can't even pick them up and eat them from your hand. You have to eat them with fork and knife from a plate, right? And then if you go, for example, to where I grew up, far up north in Sweden, up into almost at the Norwegian border, historically much poorer as a region, a sandwich even today is more likely a piece of flatbread with some butter and cheese. You know, so it really says a lot about the history of the region.
And so part of that sandwich, it's a very simple kind of basic formula that you're putting together there, but obviously the bread is an important element of that. And you talk about there being a difference in the farther north and the more southern Nordic cuisine and what kind of bread that they tend to use.
Yeah, there is a difference because if you look at, for example, at the loaf of bread is a real kind of luxury item, really, because you have to eat it almost the same day that it was baked for it to be any good, you know. So for a loaf of bread to become an everyday staple in people's homes, you really have to have bakeries. And to have bakeries, you have to have a dense population that can support them. And in the Nordics, you'll only really find that in the southern parts of Sweden and Norway and in Denmark. So that area will have a traditional loaf, for example. If you go further north, where you only really had farmlands and no cities up until quite recently, there isn't any tradition of commercial bakeries up until perhaps 100 years ago. And people bake bread maybe two or three times a year. And loaves of bread, as I said before, they're not very tasty if they're not baked on a daily basis. So instead of that, maybe you made flatbreads that could be dried and stored, you know, in big stacks and used throughout the year.
I want to talk about the recipe that you sent our way. It's a recipe for Norwegian thick salt pork pancakes. This is up right now on the Central Time website. Tell us about those pancakes.
That's a dish that you'll find being cooked quite often in Norwegian homes today. And it's a slightly thicker, thin pancake, maybe 5 or 6 millimeters, quite eggy. And it's fried in a pan together with salt pork or bacon. And you use the fat that renders out of the meat itself to fry the pancake in. And it's quite often sprinkled with some chopped chives and things like that as well.
It sounds really, really delicious to me. And
it
was funny that you said earlier that people think if you add lingonberries to a recipe, it automatically makes it Swedish. But actually, one
maybe
of the
maybe I was over-exaggerating a little bit there, but it's kind of true.
But one of the possible additions to these pancakes are actually sugared lingonberries. So what is it about the flavor combination of savory pork and sweet pancakes and lingonberries that make it work so well?
I think the lingonberry is interesting because it's quite a tart berry, and it keeps very well. It has a naturally high levels of benzoic acid in it, so it never goes moldy and never goes bad. And you can just add a little bit of sugar, and it keeps forever. So it's a very convenient thing to have on hand. So I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why it's sort of turned into an everyday staple and a condiment that all through the Nordic region is combined with different savory foods.
Here in Wisconsin, we have cranberries, which are also quite
similar.
And it does go along with a lot of things, kind of bringing out the other flavors. So I'm guessing the lingonberries would do the same.
Definitely. They are quite similar in flavor profile, lingonberries and cranberries.
You had an interesting part of the cookbook where you talked about, I guess it's pronounced fika in Sweden, yep. which seems to be code for little snacks throughout the day, which I think sounds like a great idea. But can you tell us about the fika or fika?
Yeah, it's a snack in between meals, basically. And quite often it's a cup of coffee with something next to it. You know, it could be a cookie or a bun. It could be a sandwich. It could be something more substantial than that as well sometimes. And it's really kind of an institution. And you'll see in many Swedish workplaces that perhaps people start a day, you know, together sitting down for a cup of coffee and a quick snack. And, you know, in between the normal meals like lunch and dinner, you'll slip little fika moments in.
We're talking to Magnus Nilsson now about the food traditions and recipes of Scandinavia and beyond for Food Friday. He's the author of the Nordic Cookbook.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite Nordic dish and what traditional Nordic foods does your family still make? Do you have any favorite Nordic recipes? If you've ever traveled to that region of the world, what was your experience with the food like? Call 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a minute. Right now, here are a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion about Nordic food culture now with Magnus Nilsson. He's the author of the Nordic Cookbook.
We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite Nordic recipes with us. What Nordic foods or dishes are important to your family traditions, and will some of them show up on your holiday table? How has this region's food culture affected the way you eat? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our calls right now. We've got Mike joining us first in Whitewater. Mike, hi.
Hi. I was just listening to your show. It made me realize that in the last week, I ate lutefisk at a lutefisk dinner at a little Lutheran church, and I just made 15 pounds of what I grew up calling Swedish potato sausage. And then I also bought lingonberries.
So you're really having a Nordic week so far.
I'm ready for the holidays. These were always traditional holiday foods when I was growing up.
Oh.
And even now that I'm an adult that moved away from where I grew up, I still have to have them at the holidays.
What is that potato sausage, Mike? Tell me what that is.
Well, it's 10 pounds of potatoes, 3 pounds of beef, 2 pounds of pork. Everything's ground up, mixed together with some onion and some spices, and the spices vary depending on whose recipe you use. But I always had it at my grandparents' house at Christmas, and it was referred to as Swedish potato sausage. A Jewish friend of mine tasted it once and said, "Oh, it's hash." And of course it is, but he really... I was so disillusioned when he said that because, you know, for me it was this really special Swedish thing we had at Christmas.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you, Mike. And Magnus, what about those foods that Mike ate, the lutefisk, the potato sausage, the lingonberries? Does that sound like some of the things that show up in your cookbook?
And definitely. And it's interesting because they're all examples of food that has been preserved to keep. You know, the lutefisk, of course, but also those potato sausages. And to make high starch content sausages is quite common, especially in central Sweden, because you can induce lactofermentation. You know, lactobacillus consuming those starches in the potato, producing lactic acid, and thereby preserving the sausage for, you know, making it possible to keep it for a really long time.
Now, Mike mentioned that different spices are used depending on who's making their Swedish sausage. And I think often when we think about the taste of a particular culture's cuisine, it's really about the spices and the seasonings. Are there some seasonings and spices that are used really consistently in Nordic culture?
I think especially in Sweden and Denmark, you can find quite a lot of sweet spices in the traditional recipes because both countries had their own East Indian companies and did a lot of trading. You know, historically. So you'll have a lot of cardamom, cinnamon, cloves, ginger, nutmeg, allspice, stuff like that.
And let's go back to the phones, and Aaron in Spring Green is up next. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi.
So while I was listening to your radio show, I, remembering back during the holidays, as the previous caller said, we would always have those traditional foods, lutefisk and lefse. And I also remembered back when I was in middle school, my parents took me to Sweden, and we went to visit some relatives in Bodø, Norway. So we drove from Stockholm, Sweden to Bodø, Norway, and along the way we would stop different places to eat. And one place that I remember vividly is a church that was having, I think, a reindeer celebration, potluck. And we pretty much were eating reindeer meat. Blood sausage was one of the things that I remember eating.
Magnus, does that sound like a common dish?
Well, in certain parts, definitely. And the reindeer in Scandinavia is, they are all property of the Sami population, the semi-nomadic indigenous population of northern Scandinavia, who hold reindeer, and like large parts of their food culture is based on, you know, using pretty much everything on the reindeer.
We're talking right now for Food Friday with Magnus Nilsson, the head chef of Favikin in Sweden, and he's the author of the Nordic Cookbook. And Magnus, here in Wisconsin, we pride ourselves on our cheese. We're the cheese state, in fact. How important is cheese to Nordic cuisine?
It's actually very important. At least in the northern parts of Scandinavia, between Norway and Sweden, you can have a lot of very very good dairy culture. And it's really a part of the region which is has a food culture based on dairy and grains.
So looking at the geography of Northern Europe, Magnus, the landscape is really dominated by water, both around the coasts and in the interior as well. How does that influence Nordic food culture?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing with every cultural expression, that it's it's a consequence of the circumstances where it's practiced. And with food, that becomes very apparent, because if you live close to water, food culture, like rich fishing waters at least, food culture inevitably becomes rich in dishes based on fish. And you can see this throughout the whole Nordic region, both today and historically, like, for example, with the importance of herring, both Baltic herring from the Baltic Sea and herring from the North Atlantic.
Well, we have a caller who would like to talk about herring. Brian in Madison is on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I lived in Sweden when I was growing up, and I remember going to a party out in the country, and I rode my bicycle out there, and as I got closer and closer, I smelled something like roadkill, but it was actually, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It was actually surströmming, and if I remember correctly, it's fermented, herring, and it was, I think I even had to leave because the cabin smelled so bad. It was, and I was told that if you put on enough mustard and whatever, it tempered the flavor, but it was really, really foul.
And memorable, obviously.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, Magnus, the fermented herring.
Surströmming is a dish that's unique to Sweden. And fish fermented with salt is not at all unique to that particular place, but it has been done all over the world. But what's unique to surströmming is that it's fermented in a tin can. And that gives, you know, it's an anaerobic, an oxygen-free fermentation. So it keeps all that aroma locked up into the can. And it's really, like, you know, it was invented as a way of preserving Baltic herring, you know, and transporting it to various parts of the country. And today there is obviously no such need, because you can transport it fresh or you can freeze it, but still people keep this tradition alive. And especially towards the end of summer in the northern parts of Sweden, you're going to, you know, if you drive with your window open through village after village, you're going to feel the scent of surströmming lasting through the car.
Now, last year, my husband and I bought our first Eselskiver pan without really knowing what they were, and I saw them in your cookbook today. These are these little, I guess, pancakes from Denmark. Can you tell us about Eselskivers?
So they are little donuts, basically, that you fry in a special pan with, how would you describe it, little dimples in it, perhaps. So basically, it's a puffed up pancake that's almost brown. It can have different fillings, and it can also be just plain dough.
So, Magnus, you're an acclaimed chef in Sweden, so obviously you already know a lot about food, but in the process of researching this huge book and going around and eating all of this food, what did you learn in the course of writing the book?
One of the most interesting things I learned was the fact that I knew very, very little about the region I thought I knew a lot about. You know, I'm still kind of astonished about the variation and diversity of food culture within the Nordic region.
Well, Magnus, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Magnus Nilsson. He's the head chef of Favakin. It's in Sweden, and he is the author of the Nordic Cookbook. He was with us to talk about Nordic cuisine on this Food Friday.
And don't forget, his recipe for that thick salt pork pancake is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.